So this week's talk is given by Dr. Art Lembo, Associate Professor of the Department of Geography and Geoscience at Salisbury University, Maryland. His talk is entitled Exploring the Potential of Using Your Teenager's Gaming Computer as a High Performance Computer HPC GIS Workstation. Dr. Lembo joined the Salisbury faculty in 2007 after spending 7 years at Cornell University, where he won the Cornell University Faculty Innovation and Teaching Award, the North American Colleges and Teachers of Agricultural Teacher of Merit, and the prestigious State University of New York Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching. Prior to his time at Cornell, Art spent 10 years in private industry implementing large-scale GIS systems for both public and private sector, and was also president of the American Society for Photogrammetry and Remote Sensing Central New York region. He also has numerous research interests ranging from spatial databases and web mapping to more exotic open source GIS, the hugest event yesterday, and it's his interest in parallelizing GIS that's particularly caught our eye. And this, for those who don't know, certainly was once the home of the Parallel Architectures Lab. Something close to our hearts. Art is also interested in nurturing students at an early stage to embrace all that studying geography and spatial problem solving offers them, and so we therefore look forward to a very interesting talk on a subject appropriately perhaps enjoying some sort of degree of rebirth. So without any further prose, let me present Art Lembo.
Great, thank you. So we've got how many students? And faculty. Okay, so we've got about one end. So what I'm going to do, we call it Stay in the States, is try to thread the needle in terms of trying to speak to a number of different things, because I assume, like Dr. Gettings, who's foundational in some of the things that I'm going to talk about, there's going to be some review that he's very familiar with, but for some of you others, I want to spin you up on some of the ideas here. Famous quote by Seymour Cray, have you ever heard of the Cray computer? If you're a plowing field, which would you rather use, two strong oxen or 1,024 chickens? Right, I'm going to talk about how we improve the speed of GIS through parallel processing. Now, there's one way we're going to talk, or at least at the QGIS meeting, I only spoke about something called the graphical processing unit. Today, I'm going to expand it out. So these are all leftover computers from our secretaries, and we're building a very large cluster, so we're stacking them up and getting ready to go. So I'm going to talk about both of those kinds of ways in which we do things. This started out as part of what's known as the National Science Foundation, or NSF-REU, Research Experience for Undergraduates. So where I teach, we are primarily an undergraduate institution. So our undergraduates get our full attention as professors, so we try to get them involved in research. So for what we wanted to do was to develop a plugin for QGIS that performed terrain-based parallel processing. So I'm going to show you kind of what we did with that, and talk to you about some multi-core processing, massively parallel processing on GPUs, graphical processing units. So we'll talk about the difference of that, some of how the hardware is developed, and then the plugin that we developed, and then kind of the road ahead. So the Research Experience for Undergraduates is a 3-year National Science Foundation grant. We got it extended for 2 more years because we had some really good success with some papers. And there's all kinds of different research that's being done. Some computer science professors are doing cryptology. Others are doing tomography, sonogram type work in parallel processing. So they brought me in early on to this to be a mentor to the undergraduate students to look at how to perform parallel processing for GIS. So to give you a little understanding of where this came about, in 1971, this is a picture of Ted Hoff. He designed the Intel 4004 chip. So it was designed by Intel Corporation and sold to a Japanese calculator company called Bizicomp. And after they had sold it, they realized this is a pretty nifty little idea. And they went back and said, can we buy this idea back from you? And they bought it back for $60,000. And that's really what began the computer revolution. Anyway, this chip, by the way, is on the Pioneer spacecraft. So it has been going on and on for more, in fact, the edge of our solar system right now. It had 2,300 transistors, but due to using lithography now, they're able to shrink these things, and 582 million transistors on a quad-core type computer. And then his counterpart, one of the people that hired him, was named Gordon Moore. Now, Moore has a phrase called Moore's Law. Who's heard of Moore's Law? Okay, a number of you have. Great. So this I can go quickly because it's the idea that the computers are going to double every 18 months. Well, about every 24 months, computer power or speed began to double, mostly related to transistors, and you can see sort of how it actually shades out. But we did hit a point where that sort of stopped happening. So before you buy a computer, you'd say, let me wait a couple more months. These are going to get really cheap, but the faster ones are going to come out next. But that stopped. And the main reason, we could go into, I want to get to other stuff in the presentation, but it's heat. It's heat dissipation. The ability to take heat out of the computer and dissipate that was getting too difficult. Some friends you might have who are gamers used to play this game where they'd overclock their processors, and then they water cool them, right? Just to try to keep things from burning out. You're shaking your head. You do some of that? You did? Okay, yeah. Because the problem is, it just takes a lot of effort to get more out of it, and that's what we run into. There's other issues too, like the radio frequencies back and forth. The fact is, the speed of light still has to obey a speed limit, and people were designing chips with where things were near one another because it does take the speed of light time to travel even short distances. So there was a number of issues that really prevented, but the engineer basically said heat was the main problem. So the thought was, let's parallelize them. So here you can see Prey computer, touchstone Dell, but you notice it's in a curve. Why? Because they're trying to reduce that travel time for the radio frequencies. So what hardware manufacturers did was they built things like quad-core and dual-core computers. You can put multiple chips, right, or multiple dies on or multiple chips on a single die to try to do that. There have been quite a bit of limited uptake. So I can speak to you guys as geographers. So one of the things we know is ESRI is coming out with their ARC Pro, right, which is a 64-bit system. It's 2016, guys, right? So 64-bit computing has been around for a very, very long time. There's not a lot of traction in, or wasn't in the GIS field initially. It's also difficult to code. How many people have done any multi-code threading? Okay, it's just not a straight shot. You really have to think these things through. Parallelizing stuff is even more difficult. Now, there's a real desire to do this in scientific computing, right? I have that need and work with Terrain, so I want the hardware manufacturers to do something that's going to allow me to parallelize what I'm doing so we can get things to run faster. But who cares what I have to say? And even in the scientific world, there's, we don't really have, we're not the 800-pound gorilla that comes in the room, but gaming is. And this is many years ago, but Grand Theft Auto, if anybody plays that game or not, made $500 million in its opening week. Pirates of the Caribbean and Spider-Man 3, which I didn't like the movies, but they were blockbusters in terms of how they did the box office, made under $200 million. So all of a sudden, the gaming companies, I said, who cares? Well, I have to say nobody. Who cares what the gaming company has to say? Everybody, because there's real money to be made. By the way, anybody know what the Grand Theft Auto that came out about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, how much it made opening weekend? $1 billion opening weekend. So this is surpassing what Hollywood does. So when they say, you better do something to get me past Moore's Law, you better believe that the hardware manufacturers are going to come up with reasons for that. If you have played some of those games, you realize when a guy gets shot, the blood's everywhere, it's not cartoons. It's real physics-based modeling of the drips of the blood and other things that happen. So really, really fast computation time to happen. Well, they have the money to support it because they can say, look, I release this game, and come Monday, there's $1 billion that just made it into what we're doing. So NVIDIA stepped up to then say, okay, we can provide some things to do this, and they developed graphics cards. So on that opening slide, I showed you a whole bunch of computers, but I showed you a card as well. So the graphics cards have what are known as graphical processing units on them. So on each card, the ones I started with when we got this had 400, 500. Now we're getting 1,500 to 2,000 small graphical processing units on each card that we can hope to exploit. Now, again, for gaming, a lot of this was to make really super cool-looking graphics. We're not so interested in the graphics, but those GPUs are sitting there for us to perform math computations, so we figured we may as well make use of it. This is, for those of you who haven't written any kind of parallel code, this just gives you a quick idea. This is a short little silly Python script I wrote that sums up a whole bunch of numbers. I just want to get everybody's, because I know we have a lot of students here, maybe in the background, just kind of get our heads around this. Here's the main part of the program, and up here is just a little subroutine where I sum some numbers, right? No big deal. But here is sort of the command and control center. I set up a queue. I'm importing a multiprocessor object. Oh, yeah, who's programmed in Python here? Okay, like ArcPy has to do some of that. Okay, good. So I call this multiprocessing object that I can bring in, and I set up four different processes because I have a quad-core computer center. Okay, we got four quads. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to send a list of a bunch of numbers within the queue. Right, so this kind of sets it up, and then here I'm saying, okay, start each one of these processes. Right, so it's going to call this sum routine. Now, what's happening is, in the back end, invisible kind of to the programmer, is they're handling some of the nasty work that I don't have to worry about, which is they'll throw each of these processes on a different quad, on a different core. And then I get those results, and then I can print it out and do all the work. So the idea is, though, I took a lot of data, and I split that data up among four cores. But if I just didn't do it, I have to actually control where I got the data from, how I sent it, how I received it back, and what I did with it. So that's a general idea that I'm going to refer back to the slide as we go. But for what we're doing, we're using what's called a GPU and CUDA, which is the Compute Unified Device Architecture, which is something that NVIDIA came up with to make use of all these graphical processing units on the card. I'm not going to get too far into this, but let's see what happens as we get to more. So we then, in working with our undergraduates, said, okay, what are some problems we could potentially work with? Well, for us, in working with terrain modeling, on doing things like slope aspect and those sorts of things, we're getting better at collecting data, especially with LiDAR, right? So we're getting much higher resolution data, much larger data sizes. So some of the things that we do when we work with this data is we generalize the resolution. So I've got this, you know, half meter resolution, and I'll resample it to 2 meters so I can actually work with it. Well, that's unfortunate that we have to do that. Or I'll use a smaller data set, right? Because I can't deal with all the data. Well, again, this means the world doesn't stop outside my data set. So this, we thought, would be a really good test to see what kinds of things can we do with these graphics cards. Now, we could invest in clusters, and we didn't do that. We eventually did. I'm going to tell a little bit of that story at the end of this. But we thought, what if we could do something that would be much easier to leverage, which is using a graphics card that you have on an ordinary teenager's gaming PC. So just three terms here. So parallel processing, we kind of talked about that. We're going to allow the computer to perform multiple computations in the same clock cycle. So in one clock cycle, I can perform multiple things. With my quad-core computer, I can perform four different operations. With my graphical processing unit that I have 1,000 GPUs on my card, I can perform 1,000 simultaneous computations in a single clock cycle. Right? So this is kind of what we're thinking with parallel processing. So the GPU is the graphical processing unit. The CPU are the actual computers themselves. Okay, these are better at complex because it's an actual computer, right? Where the other thing about these, they perform math computations, bam, bam, really fast. So you're going to hear when you come out, oh, I heard you got this CUDA stuff. And a guy from the United States said, dude, I'm going to slap a couple of those cards in there and really make my GIS stuff scream. Like, no, that's not really how it works. They just perform math. Throw in two numbers, add it, or actually throw in thousands of numbers, and they can add them all at the same time, right? But you're not going to be doing any kind of real processing like you would on the CPU. So that also makes us think, okay, what problems are appropriate for the GPU, and where do we have to go for the CPU? So this is the test environment we work with. There's 1,344 cores. There's 2 gigabytes of RAM. Just a little heads up. It's like, oh, that's a lot, right? Not really, because if I'm going to do work on a core, or on a card, I need to get the data on it, do the work, and get the answer. I can't destroy my data. So really, instead of 2 gigabytes, I really only have 1 gigabyte, because I got to share this data. And then we got a Xeon Intel processor. This is the computer in my office. This is the dark one. And the funny story here, I went to buy it at Walmart. And the university said, we're not going to let you buy a computer at Walmart. I said, no, I want this. They said, oh, we only buy Dell. And finally, they said, why do you want a computer from Walmart? And I said, because I want to give these presentations on the research we do, and I want to say I went to Walmart, I bought some hot dogs, a pair of socks, and a supercomputer. And I want to actually illustrate that we can do these kinds of things, not on some special rig I specced out from Dell, but I'll go to Walmart and I'll pull something out that a 14-year-old kid is using to play a game in his basement and start to leverage that in GIS. So they finally allowed me to do it, and I've had problems with computer ever since, because they were right, it was a Walmart computer, so I had to deal with that, but We got it to work out. All right, so what we decided to do is really just start with two common GIS functions, slope and aspect. These are what are known as embarrassingly parallel processes. So the idea is, for a 3x3 kernel, I want to calculate what's happening here. And I don't have the formulas here, I have them at the QGIS conference, but basically something you see out of Paul Wolfskill's book or Longley's book. But when I'm processing this cell for slope, it doesn't matter what any of the other cells are for slope. Right? So I can do these totally independent of any other place on the map. So think about how the GPU works. I can give it this kernel, and this one, and this one, and this one, and throw all of them on the card at once, get me those answers, and bring them back. Because it's not one of those things like, oh, I can't get my answer until I get the other kernel to give me something back. But they can all happen simultaneously, and they don't affect one another. We then went to Hillshade. We'll talk about that later, which has 45 calculations. All right, so this is, we used an entire county with LiDAR data in the state of Maryland. So some of our data had 1.5, 2 gigabytes. We then got up to 30, 40 gigabytes in size to start testing. Remember that program I wrote, right? That little silly one I had in the front. This is kind of a more advanced idea of what we've done. I'll talk about this. We have what is known as a scheduler. So this is the part of the program, that sort of the brains behind the operation, that sort of spins all the plates, all at once, to know what's happening. The one thing that the scheduler does is it takes data from the disk. So it calls that and starts to load the data so we can get that data into memory and then onto the GPU. So that's the part of the schedule. So there's the loader as well. So as we read it, we load it. There's also the GPU manager, which takes that data and performs those calculations, figures out how to get it back, and then sends it out so that we can save it. So this is happening, but the scheduler is actually telling each one of these operations what to do, like that earlier program where I showed you how to call the function. Okay, I guess we're going to get to the result of my other slide presentation. I must have left those out. Is there anything else to talk about here? No, I'll leave it at that. Maybe bring up the elements later if people want to see some of the code. Okay, so let's talk about some of what we did. We first decided to take a small 25 megabyte terrain model and a 200 megabyte terrain model and run a serial version and a parallel version. So we used Python, we rewrote it, we had the students write it in C++. We used QGIS sort of a sanity check, and then we used PyCUDA. So PyCUDA is a Python implementation of the CUDA architecture. So the thought was, this is going to be really nice, because everybody can write Python, so this should be easy. My slides don't have it here, but actually, we still have to write C code, but submit it as a string. So that's text. So we couldn't quite get away from that. But if you look at this early on, our slope calculations, you know, QGIS was the fastest, PyCUDA was fast, C++ as well, Python was really slow. One of the takeaways, again, if you program in Python, was one of the reasons that PyCUDA was so much faster is the read-write functionality that it's using is written in C++, or written in C, and it's wrapped by Python. So anybody use things like NumPy? Okay. If you're going to read data, and you're going to use NumPy already, use the NumPy library to read the data, because the raw Python is going to be a little more interpretive, so it's going to take longer. So one of the takeaways was, if you have the option, use PyCUDA, use NumPy, use anything to do rudimentary Python operations rather than using straight Python. But what we could see here again was just doing things in Python was really slow compared to all the other versions. The other thing too. When you first get into doing some of this parallel processing and again, writing the Python code to do it, you see results pretty quickly. Like, this is great. But then you start to scratch your chin and say, okay, is there something more that we can do? And this is sort of the evolution that our undergraduates had to go through. Was they're saying, well, this is really great. We're so much faster serially. But the thought is, yeah, but can we get even better? And this is where the real power of having the computer scientists get involved in this is for us. So that was stage one, just straight out of the box. The students didn't know what they were doing. The next thing was we started thinking about threading. So go back to our earlier slide. So what's happening is, when we first wrote this out of the box, we get the data, we put it on the card, we process it, and when it's done, we write it. Now we go get some more data, put it on the card, process it, and write it. What we realize is, well, we have a multi-threaded computer. computer. So why not make use of those CPUs? So for part of it, let's use one thread to read data, another thread to start processing the data, and another thread to do some of the writing. So in this case, we've reduced some of the waiting time for the data as we gave it to the GPU. So we see here our one and a half, actually, we'll go to the 200 megabytes. Yeah. So our 200 megabyte file was done in 28 seconds, and now we get it down to 9 seconds. So it's now faster than QGIS, and why? Because before we were getting data and just kind of waiting until it's done before we got something else. So this is where the money is as you guys graduate and get into development. It's not, what can I do with CUDA out of the box, but how do I start to just chip away at this? So then we started getting into some, we said, okay, this is too fast. Let's just work with some bigger data. So we got a 1.5 gigabyte file. And you notice, not so good anymore, right? So I guess that's 15 minutes. Oh no, 15 seconds, that's right, yeah. So we're faster, but now we're not. So what's happening? Well, there's other things QGIS was doing, being a little bit smarter than us to figure out how to work this. And even, by the way, compared to C++, we're from a serial version. So this is the serial version, and we're still twice as fast. But we knew that there was more that we could do. And this is just one of the slow times. So the next thing we started to think about was the number of computations. So we've already got the data on the card, and we process it, and we read more data with another thread. But we thought, what if we add more computations? So remember what I said, that the slope and aspect had about 15 computations per data element. Hillshade had about 45, right? So about 3 times more. So we said, let's run this thing again. We have a 12 gigabyte file, because things are running so fast. So look at the 1.5 gigabyte file. So in that one, we're at, again, 9 minutes for QGIS, 9 minutes, 4 seconds for the Python, for slope. Now we're going to do Hillshade, which is requiring 3 times many computations. So what we saw was QGIS jumps up to 11 minutes. Why? Because it's just got to do more things. Because to get to a Hillshade, you kind of have to do a slope anyway, right? An aspect along the way. But when I saw this, I said to the students, you ran the wrong thing, because it's 904, and they said, no, we didn't. So we tested. Sure enough, this was the same amount of time. And what we concluded as we started playing with the data is that card, remember, had over 1,000 cores on it. We weren't coming anywhere near close to saturating the card. We could have probably done, instead of 45 calculations, 60. And it wouldn't matter. Once that data was on there, the card just blasted it. So by increasing the number of computations, the entire process didn't take any longer to deal with because the card was just so incredibly efficient. So that was kind of stage two. So we've dealt with, so now we're dealing with, you know, first writing some parallel code, then the next thing is dealing with some of this I/O, right, so doing it at the same time. Next thing we're thinking about is the number of computations. The next part we dealt with was how do we deal with the way we're reading in data. So the phrase you're going to hear is the bottleneck. The bottleneck for all of this was the I/O, getting the data in, getting data out. We just saw it before. It doesn't matter. Throw as many calculations as this thing as possible. It's not changing it. Remember, this is the same file. So the I/O was the same for what we're doing. And this was, winds up being the same as well. Okay, which what we saw with QGIS, though, same I/O, but longer to process. So we played around with different reads. So we looked at increasing the number of lines that we read in one pass, and that's where you got to get into tricky stuff. But I don't want to blow out the memory either. So we wound up playing with reading more data out along the way. And here's where we got. Remember, we were at 9 minutes. We now got it down to 3 minutes. Right, so we're parallelizing everything just like before. And we're also multi-threading our I/O. But the other thing we thought is, how do we, what we call chunking, how do we chunk the data and get in big enough blocks? Because the problem is, think about when you're waiting online for coffee. If you're waiting on one line, it's taking a while. If I can grab more data, and not enough to destroy the hardware, right, or to step on the memory locations, and find that sweet spot, we can get to run faster. So what we decided to do was look at the input, output, and the computation time, And what you see here, again, we're down to 3 minutes, which is terrific, but our computation was 1 minute. So the actual computation of the aspect was 9 times faster, and we're about 3 times faster overall. And again, notice these things, if you add them all up, they're more than 335. And why is that? Because, remember, we're processing at the same time we're reading and writing, so some of the multi-threaded aspect of this, it really becomes apparent here. So in this case, the sum of the parts is actually greater than the whole. So we played around with, and I don't know the answer to this, how big, what's the best thing to chunk with? So we saw, for the rash we were working with, reading it about 15 lines at a time to chunk it, and I thought, no, it's got to have something to do with the number of rows or number of columns in our data set, right, because it's really big. We tried it in all different ways, and it always came down to 15 lines. So we really don't know why that's happening. So it's more that, again, this is good for the undergraduates to explore. But we started to realize, again, the only limitation now is how fast we can send the data to the GPU is what we're dealing with. Here are just some results if you look at what we did with the QGIS data and the Python data. For the different file sizes, the CUDA, again, is 3 minutes compared to 11 for QGIS. We then went to an 8 gigabyte file. Now, I don't have it written down in terms of how many pixels that is, but that is an enormous file. We're still faster, but not as much. And part of that is how we begin to deal with the I/O. So we just have to get smarter with this as well. We also broke things down with the hillshade and the slope. And again, notice here, the hillshade is taking about 9 minutes in QGIS to run that process, where the slope was only taking about 5, because there's way more computation. But in our case, it didn't matter how many, because once it's on the card, before 45, before 15, I don't care what you do. At that point, we have so many GPUs available to us, it works out great. And you can see here, even QGIS, some of the parts don't equal the whole, so they're doing a good job of trying to do some multi-threading as well. But again, we did a really nice job here. Let's see, I think from here. Yeah, you can just see the I/O bottleneck again. That's really where our rate-limiting factor is in terms of how much time we have to wait. So the output takes quite a bit longer because I have to wait for the GPU to pass the data to the saver. So again, how do I just chip away at a little bit more? Well, let's figure out better ways to pass the data back and forth between the GPU and memory on the computer. So one of the things we found is that CUDA is very efficient when I have a small number of data elements, but massive calculations per element. Okay. Here's the problem. When any of us work with terrain-based, we typically have enormous data sets with few computations per data element. Right? 8, 25, 45, that's nothing. The key is, what if I had data where once it's on the card, just keep slamming it with calculations? We don't do that. 8 calculations and we're out on the slope. So what we've wound up looking at, look at our timings. These input and outputs are now as fast as a window copy command. This computation time, that's essentially zero for all intents and purposes. So what we're discovering is you cannot do a hillshader on a 1.5 gigabyte file any faster than we do. So that really leads to this issue is it's not so much the data anymore, it's the nature of the problem. That we have to find problems that require more computations per data element. For us, these really big files require lots of passing forth from the disk to memory to the card and back to the disk again. So what are those geography problems that require lots of calculations per data element? So that's kind of what we're searching for. Next thing I want to get into, and by the way, we did this, we ran some 9x9 kernels on slopes. There's like over 100 computations to do something like that, and we found like a 50 times speed up. But how many have used a 9x9 kernel for a slope? Now, it's kind of academic in nature. It proves the point. If I can do something that has these huge numbers of computations, I'm going to see an increase, not a 3 times, but a 50 times. But nobody's doing that, right? It's not really practical. So again, the question we have is, what are the problems? All right, so that was a little bit of GPU. The other thing we did 1 year with our students, just last year, was looking at multi-core processing. I'm going to talk about a garagetronics processor later, so just work out of your basement, figuring something out. But we use something called Hadoop, or spatial Hadoop. So again, let's change our focus. We just looked at using the graphics card to perform all these processes. Now we're going to look at CPUs. So last summer, we took some vector data and tried to do some classic GIS overlay, point polygon kind of tests with that. So Hadoop is a parallel processing framework that allows us to use multiple machines. So now we have what we call slave computers and a master computer. Remember my program before? I kind of had that master there, right? I said, let's work on these GPUs, or even the little diagram I showed you before of our process. We do have a master, and it controls the slave. Well, in the same way, we're now using a computer to actually do that. So we wrote our program, we had our students use what's called MapReduce and programmed in Java. And the data now, it basically will take our data and we map it out. And when we say map, not in the term of a map that you see on a wall, but actually mapping out the data and then the reduction, go out, do a bunch of processes, and then come back with me for the answer. Like if I had a big math problem, I might ask everybody at every row to calculate, take the sum of a bunch of numbers. So what I've done is I've got all these numbers, but I've now reduced it to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rows. So I got big data that's reduced to 5 numbers. You come back to me with the 5 numbers, and I'll add them up here. So it makes it a lot easier. So that's the concept of the MapReduce. And basically what Hadoop does is it splits the data up, our master file, and places it on any computer or any processor that you might have out there. So the master file references each data file and gives a minimum bounding rectangle. So it's basically, and they do this in library science too, I think, to find books and things. We just know where certain file systems are. So the master knows where to find certain data on other computers at this point. And then the data itself, each of these data files, has the actual data and is split into different blocks that the master knows where to go for the blocks. So in this case, we then built a cluster. We got 2 computers. Put them together. It was a 2-node cluster. We had hard disk drives, not SSDs, so that's going to come into play a little bit later, and no real local storage, so we had it all on the server. So the talk that we used to give, and this is part of a talk with the GPU, but when we talk about this alone, we call it from days to hours to minutes to seconds. So we had a problem. We had 400 provincial boundaries in Southeast Asia, each with thousands of points. Again, lots of detail in each polygon. And then we had a point polygon test of 37 million mangrove locations that we were working with. What we wanted to find out was which polygon is each mangrove in, or which provincial boundary, or how many provincial boundaries, or any of those types of questions. When we were working with commercial GIS software, I won't mention the vendor name, it was going to take days. It just couldn't run, probably over a week. Every time they tested, it didn't work. So the interesting thing was, when we started the summer with our undergraduates again, we weren't planning on doing this, but a faculty member at Salisbury University did mangrove research, and he couldn't solve this problem. So let's see if we can get the students to do it. So we set up Spatial Hadoop, and we tried to run this on our 2-node cluster. We ran for 24 hours, and hadn't finished, but looking at where it completed, we figured about 5 days. Which is, 5 days is a whole lot better than not finishing, because all the other GIS backers are just exploding. So the first thing we did was, before we even got into any parallel processing, we thought, let's try to be smart about how we handle this. So we looked at this concept of decomposition. I think Dr. Getting's probably done a lot in this area. Remember, these polygons have thousands of points in them. Right? You guys have an algorithms class where you look at point polygon tests, right? Do that stuff. Lots of computations to figure out how many times a line crosses or a point crosses a line. So what we did is we took each polygon and we broke them up into smaller areas. Okay, so then what winds up happening, we found the minimum bounding rectangle of each polygon, like you see here. Then we divide that into a quadrant. Wait for that. Okay, then we create brand new polygons from that. And there's our new polygon. So now the next thing we do is we divide that quadrant up. And we just keep doing this. So we went from about 400 polygons to about 50,000 polygons. So a paper I wrote, this is called When More Is Less. So it's like, that's kind of crazy that you would take a file with 400 polygons and explode it to a file with tens of thousands of polygons. Well, the reason for doing that perform a spatial, to talk about it here, when you perform a spatial comparison, trying to compare it against thousands and thousands of points takes a long time. When I have a smaller polygon over here, using a spatial index, I don't have to consider anything else. When I'm trying to figure out what point in a polygon, if it's in a minimum bounding rectangle here, it's as though this stuff doesn't even exist. So even though there are tens of thousands more polygons, it finds it fast. And our point polygon test winds up only, in this case, we did it with a maximum of 10 points per polygon. We eventually used a constrained Delaunay triangulation as well. But it's a clever little thing that you wouldn't think of, it doesn't make intuitive sense. I've made more data, but it's faster. And again, the reason is I could immediately eliminate all the polygons up here once I've broken things up in a smaller space and use a spatial index. So when we did that, we were actually able to run this in a commercial GIS in about a little over an hour. But using spatial Hadoop, where we had the master go out and tell all those little slave files to calculate what they're doing, just like I told you with everybody at the table, calculate your answer, get me back the answer, and I'll assemble it later. That's exactly what we did here. And that happened in about 40 minutes. But like the last presentation, last thing we talked about with the GPUs, the trick is not to get this thing to run the first time out of the box. It's, okay, how do we start shaving more things away from this? How do we start to increase our speed? So we looked at different decompositions. And we looked at the time versus the maximum number of vertices. So we ran a bunch of tests. And this is, again, a fun thing for undergraduates to do because they don't, you know, usually they do a project and they say, here's my answer. It's like, okay, it's not good enough. Let's explore more. So it's a way to really engage them in doing some real research as they get ready to think about going to graduate school and doing research there. So as we did that, we found that when the number of points were equal to 6, it ran the fastest. But it also took the longest to decompose, right? So if you go back to our picture here, you can imagine busting these things up not to 10 points per polygon, but 6 takes longer. So it might take, you know, a half a day to bust up that file and put it on all those little slave files as well. So we did that, and what we were able to then do at 6 points per polygon with our 2-cluster node, we got down to 25 minutes. So we started with a commercial vendor that just cannot complete it, doing something out of the box that would take a day, 2 days to do or more or so, to then getting it to a little over an hour, now down to 25 minutes. So we looked at that and I said, okay, guys, we're on to something here. By the way, this is what the decomposition looked like. Right, so lots and lots of polygons where we didn't have that before. We only have 400, now just thousands. But again, if I'm looking for all this dark blue, these are points. If I'm looking for a point that the polygon's points in, I don't even consider these because they're not in the same spatial index, right? So it's just really fast. So we said, well, we're on to something. Let's do a little bit more. Let's expand our cluster. So we learned a lot more about how to use spatial Hadoop to get it up and running. And our I/O speed was really, really low. So we weren't getting good write speed. So we wanted to look at the potential of using SSPs. So to do that, we looked at Amazon. So again, our stuff is working, but we had slow connections, slow wires, and slow disks. So we said, let's get the credit card out, and we'll go to Amazon to do this. It wasn't expensive initially, right? 6 cents, okay, and about 13 cents per hour, depending upon the number of instances. The problem is, when you have all these nodes, it's 6 cents per hour per node. So I got my credit card bill from the students who were working on the weekend. I said, hey, guys, what's going on? I thought this was going to be 6 cents an hour. No, that's not what it's 6 cents per node per hour. So, okay, let's go with the lower number of nodes and see how this works. It was my personal credit card. So we set up automated scripts. Again, we had 32 gigabytes in a solid state drive, okay, a lot more RAM, so we could move the data into RAM, and the same kind of processor. So we ran this in an 8-node cluster, and that ran in 351 seconds. Then we said, let's move it to a 19-node cluster. So now we were paying Amazon. We had, actually, it was 20 nodes. So one was the master, then we had the 19 slaves. And then we got that down to 210 seconds by decomposing the data using the 6 points per polygon. Now, at this point, you know, we went from days as seconds, even though it's really minutes, right? 210 seconds. But I said, if I put a little more on my credit card, I know we can get it down more. But we proved the idea that throwing the stuff into Amazon's EC2 and having more nodes will allow us to get it down to the seconds range for this. This is the program I showed before. So the Garagetronics one, I decided to do this. I took the same program. We just did this last week with my student. I teach a GIS programming class. And part of it is SQL, and the other part of it is using Python. So they learn ArcPy, they learn to use other kinds of Python packages. And this one I want to teach the multiprocessor package for Python. So here I've got an SQL command that looks at it sums up the area of soil polygons in a four parcels that intersect them that are single-family residential, right? Something silly like that. This is the same, you notice, this is the same command as this. So we ran it this week, but now I'm using 8 processes I set up. And what I do here, I'm asking in my query where the property ID, or the unique ID for the property, is between two numbers. Well, I know how many numbers I have in the whole property database. I can divide that by 8 and then add to it. So now what I'm able to do is get those between numbers to pass in. So my function passes in the queue, as well as the low and high number for the between clause. So essentially what I'm doing is I'm processing 1/8 of the data on one core, I'm processing another 1/8 of the data on another core, and so on. So we start all 8 processes, receive all 8 back, and then we sum up all the values at land. So this is the idea of the mapping and then the reduction. And then back here, I only have to calculate 8 numbers, where my processor's calculating more. So this winds up being about 3 times faster. And part of the reason is, I say 8 cores. Do I really have 8 cores? You gamers, what do you think? Now, I really have 4 physical cores, right? The rest is hyperthreading. So I think we can play around with that. But this is what I call the Garagetronics way of doing it. It's something we can easily do in Python. You got a gaming PC that's got all these cores, why not fire them all off? So this is just, again, taking that same Hadoop concept and saying, I don't want to really deal with multiple computers, let's just work with the one that I have. So it busted up the data into 4 these parts. By the way, for those of you who uses Postgres here, okay, so what you know is, well, starting in another month or two, that's a single CPU kind of an application. So whether you have 8 cores or not, Postgres is going to only use 1 core, right? But in this case, I'm actually instantiating the Postgres process each time, so I'm actually running it on all the cores. So that's kind of a fun thing that I'm doing here. So here's my connector to CyclePG. I don't know if anybody uses that to connect in. So in this case, I'm instantiating multiple times, so we're able to actually run this on 8 separate processes. Okay, so the early results showed that these are undergraduates. I said, why do you have yarn here? They said threads. I said, okay, we'll keep it in there. And then they have the same both. So then I told them I'd leave that in. But we found that using the GPU was faster for terrain analysis compared to serial methods. We also saw that multi-threading improves the analysis quite a bit. And again, it's part of that, not just getting it fast, but how do I shave more time off? We do have the data on GitHub. I will warn you, it will take about 2 hours to install all the packages in the .NET framework and some other things that are in there so that you can use it. National Science Foundation gave us this. Now, I don't have the slide here, but I'm going to reserve time to ask the first question. Okay, so I'm going to ask you again. And it's a legitimate question because I have not received a good answer yet. You now know what embarrassingly parallel is. You now understand this idea that if I can perform lots of computations per data element rather than a few computations per data element, it's a big win. I have been talking to my colleagues, I go to conferences, and my question to all the smart Edinburgh people is, what are good geography kinds of problems that have massive number of calculations per data element? And it's because I'm seeing, you and I were talking about this the other day, Owen, 3 minutes versus 11, for all the work it took, heck, I'll deal with the 11, go out for coffee, right? So where do I find those problems that have massive numbers of calculations per data element? Go. Anybody have a thought? Again, it's not trying to set you up. It's a legitimate question that I'm having a very difficult time. Maybe Dr. Gettings knows something as well, but I am really trying to find the ones that and they have to be embarrassingly parallel, too. Right? So, thoughts? Yeah?
When I was doing my dissertation, GIS, I was working with segmentation.
Dynamic segmentation, you mean? Or?
So segmentation of velocity images. The problem is that we have, every time the problem basically is different, you can play with the different parameters, and you're going to get segmented images in different ways every time. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering whether you can use parallel processing to do that more efficiently.
Well, again, the GPU portion is just going to multiply lots of numbers all at once. Right? It's not going to do for loops type things. The CPU will run actual parts of your program in different spaces, right? Different CPU spaces. So that's where you got to think about, how do I reimagine this problem in a parallel processing realm? So that's why I said you can't just say, let's throw three CUDA cards and run faster. No. Only when you're performing math calculations can do that fast. So I don't know if you could think more about, maybe give me some feedback on the segmentation. Does that seem to fall into a GPU calculation or a multiprocessor CPU?
I don't really know. It's just one of the problems that we have several pieces in an image, basically trying to segment the image in meaningful objects in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do you go about that problem? And whether it's a GPU or CPU, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. What's that? Routing. There are people who calculate Dijkstra's algorithm in multiple CPUs, and I've even seen a GPU reference to it. So I think part of that is, again, the same idea is there are certain math things that they throw onto the GPU and other things that they'll do on the CPU. My concern with that one, I've toyed with it, I deal with undergraduates, and I think for them to write a multi CPU GPU implementation of Dijkstra's algorithm would be more than they can handle in their summertime with us. But that's one that, you're right, that has a lot of good calculations that you have to perform. But it gets, that would be a decent one. It's just, it's not GPU. See, the GPU, you could really see how the math stuff for Hillshade is different than Slope. But I think a lot of your Dijkstra's, right, you're having to write that visiting table, right, which nodes have I already visited. So I'm not sure. I mean, that would be one I have to think about. But I think that's still got a lot of I.O. in writing those temporary tables. Well, this is not all about me. So I just threw that out there and just to get some ideas. But any questions that you guys have on some of what was presented here? Yeah?
This question to do, I've never used it, when you said you start with 8 nodes,
yeah, you know what was really great about that, Phil, was it happened by the time we learned how to do it on two, we were in a room and we had two computers connected to each other. By the time we learned how to do that, spinning up 20 was a couple of hours at that point. In fact, you and I talked about Raspberry Pis, right? We tried this with Raspberry Pis and we burned them out every time. They would last for about 4 days and we just kept breaking them. And they're really slow too, so it didn't work. But the best way to learn how to build a supercomputer is buy a bunch of Raspberry Pis, go on the web, and you can do it. So the same idea. So we tried that, and the guys learned how to break the file up and then distribute it over the different processes. So, yeah, it's not hard at all. The hardest thing that probably took us 2 weeks in the summer was to learn just how to do the two nodes. Once they could get their head around it, then going to 20 was very easy. Yeah. Questions? Yeah. I just have problems with lots of things on that Walmart computer, but I had to get a new disk that burned out. Everything was on that one, but we also have the Xeon, the ones I showed you the times, but yeah, and the funny thing is, again, Moore's Law type of stuff, my Walmart computer is slower than, I was, everybody was pretty excited about what I got when I first bought that, but that's slower than the computers the students use in the lab now. So, but yeah, it all runs on that. So again, your classic gaming computer that, you're shaking your head about gaming. Do you have a gaming computer?
No, I used to buy my separate gaming graphic card.
Okay. How much RAM does your gaming computer have now?
You mean the RAM or GPU?
RAM right now.
You mean a RAM? Mine is 16.
So yeah, so you're already, I'm at 12 of mine. These are 16. How about your GPU?
My GPU, the one I have, is a cheaper one with only 3 GB, and now there are 6 GB.
Okay. 6 gigabytes, so that was more than I had. So think about it. Now I no longer have to play that game of back and forth, right? So I've just reduced half of my I.O. problem. And you probably can pick these things up for $1,200, right? So this is really leveraging this stuff. And the vendors aren't doing this, right? So where is the SRI in doing this stuff, right? Other questions? Yeah?
So the GIS problem we're trying to solve, they just don't have that matrix field system. They don't have that minority report field system. What I mean by that is, maybe there's an element of chicken and egg here. We tend to just work in very kind of asynchronous fixed worlds where the nature of what we work with doesn't demand there isn't the demand for sort of saying, God, this took us 10 days to do X. So I just don't see the demand.
Yeah.
You raised a really important question. I think we found one example, but there isn't people bashing in the doors to say, God, how the hell do we parallelize this?
Right. That's right.
Because we're not, I'm thinking about gaming worlds in which you are trying to create sort of multiple users, and you're trying to cast in those multiple users in a very highly dynamic now time. You don't want to have any, or with virtual reality headsets and stuff, where you're wanting to not have any lag.
That's right. Things are just exactly the gaming part. Because that guy, when he moves his arm, it can't do that. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where the graphics part is important.
Yeah. So I think because GIS isn't linked in or connected very much with that sort of dynamic way of viewing things, then I think the hunger and the appetite to solve these type of problems, I just don't feel it's there.
Yeah. The only area that I don't understand it well enough, because I don't have the physics background, is a lot of the climatology type of things. Because there's lots of calculations, but I don't have the physics background to really get my head around that. Yeah, yeah. But that's a really great point. Where is that demand? And I see more demand in the multi-core stuff than the GPU stuff. Because sometimes we have lots of data, it'd be great to distribute it over 20. We have a lab that sits idle on the weekend. I got 28 computers in it, so let's just run stuff on it.
Yeah, it was just sort of comment on William's comment, but that's exactly why what we were doing. What was it, 10 more years ago, kind of ground to halt, because the GIS companies who we were trying to work with were just saying, well, so what, so you've reduced it from 20 minutes to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And the other problem is, of course, that with a lot of things you're doing, it works really well with nice raster data sets that map onto these grids. And that was the other thing the companies would say to us, well, yeah, okay, it works in specific algorithms that are embarrassingly parallel, it works well there, works well with raster data sets, what about all the other data models? So we spent a lot of time trying to build generic parallel frameworks that didn't give you as big a speed up, but still went a lot faster. Mm-hmm. But we still faced the first problem, that we were saying, well, yeah, people will hang around, just go for coffee. The two areas, one you've highlighted is big environmental models, which go slowly, and okay, academics kind of think, it's going to run for a week. We've had our server downstairs, it's grinding to a halt because something was running some multi-processor job that was just grinding on and on and on and on. But the one that I think might be a killer application is when these things start getting stuck behind websites. That you've got 2 seconds on the web to give somebody a result, otherwise they go, somebody else.
Yeah.
You're not going to be running big environmental models behind a website, but you could be running reasonably sophisticated analyses on large numbers of points, large numbers of polygons.
Yeah.
And there, I think, there is an edge.
Yeah, I think you're
but
right.
You're still faced with the problem that the GIS companies are, they're not the ones that are going to be in the vanguard here, because they're not going to reinvent 40 years of code.
Fortress code.
It's going to have to be completely reinvented to do this.
Yeah.
So I think there probably is an opportunity for small, lean, new companies to come in and say, well, actually, if you want to do this really, really fast on the back end of your website, we can help you.
Yeah, I just met with a big data analytics company this morning for breakfast, and that was the issue. And you're right. It's a perception issue. For us in a GIS lab, it takes all weekend. We'll go home on Friday, come back on Monday, and it's good. But you're right.
Well,
if someone wants to do a viewshed analysis, we can pull it off in 3.5 minutes in ArcServer. But if I can get it to them in 32 seconds, the user experience has now changed, or that becomes more marketable. So that's a great point. So it's not so much can we make these 50 times faster, it's for the user experience itself and his perception of time, it may be better off for those kinds of quick one-off type applications, yeah. Others? Questions?
Lushes, probably to the parallel thing. I was just wondering about how, when you were dividing your polygon into smaller units, I don't know what's going on in the other underlying process, but if you went internally instead, would a rectangle be faster?
Yeah, that's why you think about it, like ear clipping. The ear clipping algorithms that do the internal. So, yeah, I don't remember how we went about doing that. The one I liked the best it wasn't as good because the triangulation only had 3 points, but there were so many more polygons, it wasn't as fast. But the constrained Delaunay triangulation worked a lot faster for that. So these were actual polygons that were broken into quads, so you're doing a little more line intersection. So I can't remember which algorithm we used to break that into the quadrants, but the one I did look at later was the ear clipping methods within Delaunay triangulations. Yeah?
I see from an application side of things, I find these very interesting. So I'm working in a company, we play a lot with GIS data. At the moment we're using a lot of Elasticsearch. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Amazon's Elastic server, you mean?
No. Oh, okay. We're on the cloud, but we're not using AWS.
Okay.
So, we're doing a lot of free text searches, and we're doing some geo analysis, in a sense, which is important for us. We're also playing with addresses as well, and, we try to keep the user experience at high level, in a sense. We're creating applications as well. So we're using tools, not that sophisticated as how to do, but, Elasticsearch does the job. Mm-hmm. And I think your presentation basically enhances our view in using different tools, because coming from a GIS background, usually you end up basically using the same things. We need to start thinking about big data tools.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware about spatial Hadoop.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you created.
No. University of Minnesota actually created that.
Yeah. So I find it very interesting. I don't find the comparison to different, out of the box. ESRI products,
yeah.
Fair, because those products are there to provide the diversity of tools that you work. They're actually there to provide you high ends.
That's right.
Efficiency, in a sense. We're using FME a lot, we're using ESRI as well. There's no way you can have that's when you can just look at a function, mm-hmm. just one function.
Right.
It's very easy to scale that function up.
Yeah.
But if you have a set of functions that you want to solve a specific problem, I find it will be very difficult to scale it up. Add additional nodes to get the same efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried actually scaling up a huge workflow of calculating something, or have you sticked up?
We've mostly stuck with this, because the point, what he's really saying is this idea, we do what we do really super fast, right? Because we have a grid and we're calculating slope. I don't care about coordinate systems, right? I don't care about if it's in meters or feet, just do the math, right, is what we're doing. What he's saying is, a company like an ESRI or a Manifold or someone has to worry about, there's other things people want to do with the software. But going back to what you were saying with a company, this is where some of these companies say, look, I've got this one problem that's got to get solved over and over again. And a vendor might not be able to do that, but what's hopefully is encouraging here, these are sophomore level and junior level undergraduates who are doing these sorts of things, meaning if you work for a data analytics company, and they're doing it in the summer, right? So we haven't come in for the summer. It won't take you very long to spin up a Hadoop, a multiprocessor process, or a GPU process if you have a very well-defined, specific thing you want to do. Yeah, but you're right, exactly. That there's not a breadth to what we do. We say we're going to solve this problem, so we should be faster than the vendors, because we don't worry about half of what the vendors are worried about in terms of other things their GIS does. Yep.
One of the things actually this would be useful is now with a different satellite data coming in. Now you have the sentiments view, for example. So you get every week basically you get for the same area the satellite views. But you want to analyze that pixel, for example, using specific, different indices, different classification algorithms, all those different sort of things. So for the same pixel you're gonna have multiple calculations, which is exactly what you do.
That's right, yeah.
So that might be something. And then then we have, you know, micro satellites basically coming in the next 5 years, which means that you're going to have a flock of satellites getting data from the same point.
That's right.
So that might be useful. Yeah. And if I was working for, you know, for a company analyzing that data, I'd probably do that. I would create something bespoke.
Yeah, even things like supervised and unsupervised classification do have quite a bit of statistical calculations per pixel. Yeah.
I completely agree with that, because we were just at a meeting earlier on with RICS, and one of the things that came up there was the sort of microsatellites, and I can't remember the name, there's an American company who are now running constellations of these, and they're basically doing crop futures on the basis of your daily images, and they're able to say, oh, the crops are, you know, going to be, you know, this amount of them, and they're at this particular stage of ripeness, and they're making shed loads of money by just being a few days ahead of the traditional ways of doing it. So if you add the imagery together with fast processing, which you need to do for that, then that gives you another little edge. And in the futures business, if you're 5 minutes ahead of the next guy, you can make billions.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you're right. When you start to look at, you know, how is our moisture content in the field, and the UAV land, and I want the answer in 7 minutes. You know, that's a really good one. Is I should probably look at soil moisture kind of calculations and some of this data. Yeah, because that's a case where you have hyperspectral data. You have lots. Now here's the problem we run into, right? The footprint on the graphics card, more I/O, right? So hyperspectral gives me lots of calculations, but also lots of data that goes with it. So I'm back to the problem, back and forth, back and forth. So that's where I'm losing stuff on that I/O. But yeah, that's a great. Good. Yeah. Look, I know you guys want to get to the pub. How about one or two more questions if you have any? We'll wrap it up.
No, I could ask, what is this manifold of which you speak, and how widespread is it?
I've been using manifold for a lot of years, and it's got me in trouble among some people because they don't like seeing a product like that. These guys were developing algorithms for the Department of Defense using a basically to speed up the math coprocessor. But to do that, they used computational geometry tasks, and when they demonstrated, someone said, you know, you have a GIS there, and they said, well, what's a GIS? When they explained it to them, they said, oh, this is really cool. So they are full, you know, doing parallel processing, and this is good, going back to your question before, we're faster with our terrain, but we don't worry about a thousand of the things that they worry about. So, but yeah, they are a low-cost GIS that full has a full SQL engine. We talked a bit about SQL the other day at Phil's school, because I gave a talk there on spatial SQL. But they're full spatial SQL, and they're starting to do the multi-threading and GPU work within their SQL engine. And again, like I said, keep an eye out on Postgres. They are now doing multi-processing. I talked to who's running the PostGIS? Who runs PostGIS, Phil? Paul, yeah. I saw Paul at Seoul last year, and he's like, same thing Bruce said. Yeah, we want to do it, but we're just not sure what kind of efficient, how much effort it takes to get a few seconds. Is it worth it? We're not sure. But keep an eye on Postgres to do the same thing. But yeah, Manifold is probably under $200 for a GIS that does a lot of this kind of stuff.
Food for thought.
Yeah.
Well, so we have liquid for thought. And we'll see. Thanks a minute. But thanks all for coming. Nice to see you all here. And thanks to the helpers for helping me set up, clear up. So, just before we go for drinks, thanks very much indeed to Art for a very interesting talk. Thank you.
Hello, people. Thanks for living in this country, because this has been the best academic trip I've taken in my entire career. I've just loved my time at Stirling and Loch Ness and Edinburgh. So it's been, you guys have all been a great host, everybody, but your country has been fantastic, so I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Oh, great. Thanks.